Hello and welcome to Spy Hearts Podcast, where your hosts go deep undercover into the world of spy movies to decipher which films make the knock list. But remember, this information is strictly for your ears only. I'm Agent Scott.
And I'm Cam the Provocateur, and Scott, I feel like James Bond, except no gorgeous girls.
That does sound like our life. Actually, our life is as interesting as James Bond either.
What part of James Bond do we actually have? Is there anything? We don't have the style. We're not globetrotters.
No, we don't have drinking problems.
No, I'm not a gambler.
No. Crippling loneliness?
Maybe like a sparse apartment. Maybe that.
I mean, I can see it on the camera now, folks. You are lucky. This is just an audio podcast.
Help!
There's that crippling loneliness again.
That's right. That's right.
Well, before we get to the film, we need to induct a new Spy Hard Die Hard. And Cam, why don't you tell the lovely listeners how they can become one?
Yes, of course. You can become a Spy Hard Die Hard by leaving a 5-star review on Apple Podcasts. We will then read the review and give you a very special code name.
Absolutely. And because this week's film takes place in a land down under, I thought I would head over to the Australian Apple podcast to see what you fine folks in Oz have for us. So here is the latest inductee, and it comes from Joshua. I hope I'm pronouncing that right, Joshua. 5 stars. Spy Hard makes the knock list. One of my must-listen-to podcasts, Cam and Scott are fantastic hosts who make an engaging, fun, and witty show that delves into our favorite and our not-so-favorite spy films. Some incredible interviews with filmmakers, too.
Well, thank you very much. That is very kind of you. And now it is my job to give you your special code name. Now, in the past, we were using sometimes the movie titles, but I feel like that got a little too predictable.
Mm-hmm.
So I think I'm going to abandon that, even though First Strike isn't the worst code name ever. That's actually not so bad. I'm still going to stick with like ones like Naked Runner. I mean, that one, how do you ever not use that?
Historic.
But in this case, I'm going to go with code name Great White Shark.
Oh, interesting. I thought you'd go a different way with that.
Nope, I'm going with it because we had great white sharks through the end of this movie, and I don't know how many great whites we have in the future of Spy Hards, quite honestly.
That's true. See, I thought you'd either go with Super Cop or Koala.
Koala? That's not a cool nickname.
Depends. If you're a koala, you might quite like it.
Boy, don't let Agent Scott come up with the nicknames. You'll be named like Furball.
Well,
you'll be like, what?
Yeah.
Why?
Okay. Thanks. This is why Cam does this, folks. This is why I don't do it. But Joshua, enjoy your new code name. Thank you for the 5-star review. Listeners, if you haven't already left us a 5-star review on Apple Podcasts, do so now and we'll read it out on the show. But without further ado, let's get to the review. Okay, Cam, it's time to talk about this week's film. But I can't do that until I introduce this week's guest. And you see, the film we're talking about this week has some rather calamitous chopper action. And so I thought, well, why not bring in the expert? Joining us today on the show, it is Will from the Exploding Helicopter Podcast. Hello, sir. How are you?
I'm very well, thank you. And thank you for inviting me on.
It's an absolute pleasure. I've been waiting for the right film to have you on the show. And we have had a couple of films in the past with exploding helicopters. I mean, Skyfall has a very notable exploding helicopter as it plows into a building. And I was trying to cast my mind back to any other exploding helicopters we've had, Cam. Did he jump out to you?
As soon as he said that, I was like, oh, God. Like, okay, I think there's one, I think, maybe in True Lies.
Certainly is. So. You're fired.
Yeah.
That one jumps to mind. But I'm trying to think of like the more of the action. There's got to be some exploding helicopters in Bond. Oh, the Little Nelly sequence in You Only Live Twice.
There certainly is. I think if going off the top of my head, I think 10 of the Eon Bond films have exploding helicopters in, and that's a great sequence in You Only Live Twice. It's particularly for that era in the 1960s. That one really raised the bar, and frankly it was a long time after that before sort of anyone really started catching up in terms of like quality and certainly number of exploding helicopters in that film.
And also, now that my mind is racing, For Your Eyes, not For Your Eyes Only, From Russia With Love has one, obviously, with the battle at the end, the North by Northwest-like sequence. Mm-hmm. We haven't done The Spy Who Loved Me, but that has one, obviously.
Well, we've just heard from the expert that there's 10 Eon ones. What about outside of Bond? There must be some other ones. Let's stretch our minds. What other spy films have exploding helicopters?
I think there was a film that you spoke about recently on your podcast, or recently-ish.
Oh,
which
now you're putting us.
I was a spy.
I doubt it.
Tony Scott, Brad Pitt.
Oh, Spy Game.
Spy Game.
Spy Game.
Is there an exploding helicopter?
It does. In the Vietnam flashback, the helicopter, and this is Tony Scott does this repeatedly in his career. The helicopter disappears off screen before it explodes. So a bit of a budget saving device that, but probably why it hasn't burned itself into your memory.
That makes sense. It's not the action sequence that Spy Game is based around. It's just an off-screen thing. But what I'm curious to know, maybe before we pivot into this week's film a little bit more, is your podcast is dedicated to exploring cinema's exploding helicopters. What made you want to talk about that specifically?
Well, I'm sort of amongst friends here, so I can say, it's a bit of a joke that frankly's got completely out of mm-hmm. hand. So I was watching, a trashy sort of RoboCop sort of ripoff called Cyborg Cop, excitingly
great,
enough.
Great
and
name.
A friend of mine pointed out that this helicopter sort of came into the scene, and a friend of mine pointed out that, I bet that helicopter's about to explode. And sure enough, it did. And that sort of planted the thought in my mind, helicopters explode in films like a much more really than frankly they should as a form of transport. And I then saw an amazing exploding helicopter in the film Stone Cold, the attempt to launch Brian Bosworth as a big action star.
Yep.
Truly, go and look that up on YouTube. It's a fantastic exploding helicopter. And after I saw that, I just thought, right, somebody needs to start sort of documenting, cataloging all the strange ways that helicopters explode in films. And I kind of thought that I would have be sort of, you know, I would have got them all together. I would have listed them all within about 2 or 3 years, but that was sort of 15 years ago, and I'm still, if anything, the pace of discovering new films with exploding helicopters is only increasing. I think I found about over 80 new ones last year alone. So my work, sadly, looks like it's going to continue long into the future.
Well, I mean, we've mentioned Bond. We've mentioned True Lies. Before we started recording, we were talking about Under Siege. These are all movies you expect to see exploding helicopters. Have there been any that have popped out over the course of your journey that you were like, that is not a movie I would have expected would have an exploding helicopter?
Well, the first one that comes to mind is The Life Aquatic by Steve Zissou. So Wes Anderson is not a director you associate exploding helicopters with, but he managed to find a way to include one in that film. I have to say, it's not the best example of an exploding helicopter. You don't see an awful lot of the helicopter explosion, sadly. See the aftermath of it. But he's managed to. In his twee sort of art directed to death films, he's managed to conclude an exploding helicopter. And for that, he has my respect.
I did not expect that.
No. Is that the most artistic exploding helicopter you've seen?
It certainly is. I mean, I think more of these sort of, art house sort of type directors should definitely look to flex their cinematic muscles by including an exploding helicopter in their film. I mean, there are some other directors that, big name directors out there who have never exploded in a helicopter. For example, Martin Scorsese has never blown up a helicopter, and, you have to think he's I don't know how many more films he's got left in him, but if he's going to break that duck before he finishes, he really needs to get a wriggle on.
Yeah, he doesn't tend to tackle projects where there's a lot of helicopters swooping around. I mean, I could see a helicopter exploding in, say, The Departed, but beyond that, I don't know. Not Kundun or something like that, that's for sure.
Or the Silence, yeah.
Yeah.
Not much scope for including one in those films.
No, Mean Streets, that would have been a little outside of what you'd expect.
Well, that sort of explains the genesis of the show and your work through the podcast. I want to then ask, because you know we obviously talk about spy movies, and we're doing the exact same thing for spy movies. We're trying to catalog all the spy movies ever made here. For you, you mentioned all the Eon films you knew and some of the spy films with exploding helicopters, but what are your thoughts on sort of spy movies or any ones that you sort of hold near and dear?
Well, I'm a big fan of the spy genre. I mean, not just spy films, but I love the books. I love novels. I love reading kind of, you know, sort of real life accounts of spies and spy craft, etc. And sort of any TV show which has espionage in its theme, then I will invariably check it out. So in terms of spy films though, The Ypres File is one of my favorite films, and sort of the, you know, we've talked about Bond, and that's obviously very, very much the antithesis of the Bond character. I'm a big fan of Spy Game, really enjoy that film. I don't think, you know, it's not a classic like The Ypres File, but I just enjoy the sort of, I guess, the Robert Redford's cleverness throughout that film. Other espionage films that I really enjoy. Oh, my mind is blanking at the moment, but those are the two that come to my mind, you know, straight off the top of my head.
Are you a James Bond fan?
Oh yeah, I mean, I'm British, so I've brought up on James Bond, and had those films on tape as a kid. So some of them I've seen, like, I mean, I don't know how many times I've seen Thunderball. I mean, it's
right
over. It's got to be over 30. And I'm a defender of that film. I see all its flaws, but I think a part of it is nostalgia. I just really fell in love with that film as a kid, and it remains one of my favorite Bonds.
What I'm getting here, and long-time listeners will understand the pain I'm going through right now. it feels like on the spectrum of Scott to Cam, Will is falling much more on the Cam side of things, which is fine. It's fine. I'll just keep it in mind when I give you like airtime to answer questions later. I might just cut you off midway through. in true style of this film, actually. And I suppose, speaking of them, because your spy movie credentials clearly check out, so do your exploding helicopters, let's get to it. Cam, the question goes to you. What are we talking about this week?
Yes, we are talking about 1997's Jackie Chan's First Strike, which also 1996's Police Story 4, depending on where you live, obviously.
And, I mean, this is one of those rare times for us where we're jumping into a franchise midway. We've done it a few times now. We did it with the Pink Panther Strikes Back, or Strikes Again. I can't remember which is the title of the two of those. And there's a couple more along the way that we've done that just have a spy movie within the franchise, but the rest of the films aren't spy movies.
Yeah, yeah. And the previous Police Story films are very much like police stories. Mm-hmm. Versus this one, which obviously goes more globe-trotting espionage. And it's often critiqued by fans of that series for not really lining up too well with the other films.
Okay, fair enough. Now, I've not seen any of the other ones, so I'm going in sort of blind to this. And this is not one of those films that people can critique us for saying it isn't a spy movie. It makes a very good point to say it is, and even references Bond in several occasions.
Did you ever see Super Cop?
No.
Okay, that's the third one with Michelle Yeoh, mm-hmm. and it is like much grittier, quite violent, and when you kind of compare it to this one, which is much more playful and James Bond-esque, yeah, they really don't line up very well.
Okay, well, if you haven't seen, I'm just going to call it First Strike, I think, for the rest of this episode, just to save a bit of time, all different titles. If you haven't seen First Strike, here is your synopsis. First Strike. They thought they possessed the ultimate weapon. They hadn't counted on Jackie Chan.
Well, that's good.
That's great. That is great. Hong Kong cop Jackie returns, working with Interpol to track down and arrest an illegal weapons dealer. Chan later realizes that things are not as simple as they appear, and soon finds himself to be a pawn of an organization posing as Russian intelligence. Very mysterious. I prefer the top line. They didn't count on Jackie Chan. That's one for the ages.
That synopsis is actually very coherent in explaining the espionage.
Yeah. Well, there you go, folks. Sold.
Yeah. Yeah.
Usually at this point we would ask, you know, people's previous backgrounds with the film. This is my first time watching. Maybe I'll do that, but I think maybe before that, Jackie Chan, this is the first time we're talking about Jackie Chan on the show. How about we just sort of talk about our first experience with Jackie Chan? Because I think that could open up the discussion a little bit more. Hmm. Will, you're our guest. I'll throw it to you. What was your first sort of experience with Jackie?
It's not terribly fixed in my memory, but I certainly remember watching when I was pretty young. I think it would be something like Meals on Wheels at home. And I don't really, to be honest, despite sort of growing up watching a lot of action films, Jackie Chan was not somebody, obviously I was aware of him, but he's not somebody that I ever really kind of watched many of his films. Mm-hmm. I have a bit of a, I'm not a huge, I guess it best described as being Jackie Chan agnostic. To say that I'm not a fan kind of implies I dislike him, which is not the case. Sure. I just don't actively particularly get on with a lot of his films. I obviously, you know, admire his commitment to the craft. I mean, his fight work, the stunt work, obviously the way that he puts his body on the line, got to admire that. But I have some, yeah, it's a lot of the comedic elements that he brings into his films. I mean, comedy is obviously very personal. If you're out there listening to this and you really enjoy the comedy of Jackie Chan, then, you know, by all means, enjoy his films. It just doesn't quite work for me. So I have over the years tried to sort of watch some of his sort of key films. So I have seen the first two Police Stories. I've seen Super Cop as well. I've seen Project A. But I'm not a huge fan of the man, I'm afraid.
No, that's fine. That's absolutely fine. I mean, for me, I was tracking it back earlier when I was writing my questions, and the film that jumped out to me is Shanghai Noon. I think that was the sort of big Western one probably for him. That, especially, I think it came out around about 98, so I was 11, which feels like I'm in the pocket for that film. And I think then followed up a couple of years later with I'm obviously Rush Hour.
Yeah,
that's the one I'm thinking of. Yeah, Rush Hour. Shanghai Noon was a couple of years later. Rush Hour was the one I saw first. Shanghai Noon and Accidental Spy all around the same sort of time.
Oh, I never saw Accidental Spy. But yeah, definitely the Rush Hours were a big deal. And for me, the way I discovered Jackie Chan was actually through my friend Mark. We were big fans of the movie Mortal Kombat mm-hmm. in 1995. And that my friend Mark was always really into martial arts as a very young child, and he did wind up getting his black belt in karate at a certain point. And so, like, he didn't have a lot of opinions about what movies we would watch together, but if it came to martial arts stuff, he needed to see it. And so Mortal Kombat was a huge deal. In the wake of that movie, they did a release of Rumble in the Bronx in North America, and they marketed that movie using the score for Mortal Kombat.
Okay.
And so when Mark saw that trailer, he was like, not only am I seeing martial arts, I'm hearing the score to Mortal Kombat, a movie that meant a lot to, like, he was very, very, very into Mortal Kombat. And so we raced out and saw Rumble in the Bronx and got really into Jackie Chan. And so we went and saw a number of the movies that were released in North America where they would do, obviously, recuts and whatever. So, like, the versions that we're going to talk about on the show are the North American versions in many cases, mm-hmm. which is sometimes frustrating. But I went and saw Operation Condor, Super Cop, Jackie Chan's Mr. Nice Guy, Who Am I? There was a whole streak of those that all got, like, theatrical distribution.
Yeah.
And so I was there for pretty much all of them, and also watched a lot of the ones that got released on North American home video as well. So there was a real streak of me through the late 90s into the 2000s watching a lot of Jackie Chan movies, and then obviously the North American stuff. Really liked Shanghai Noon. Rush Hour was pretty good. But there was always the frustration of, like, watching, I don't know, like, Drunken Master 2 and then going and watching the North American action sequences and being like, wait a second, these two things are not the same in any way, shape, or form.
So would you say he sort of rounded his edges a bit when he came to Hollywood. Is that what you're inferring? Like it was just a bit safer. It was a bit less edgy.
Oh, way more so, because I mean, it's probably just the restrictions of what stunt, you know, teams are willing to pull off in North American films versus Hong Kong films.
Yeah.
Just the action was phenomenal in Jackie Chan's films. Like the things they would do would be, well, you see it in any of his movies. Like, watch those blooper reels. They're incredible. There are sequences we're going to talk about in the movie today where you're like, they would never stage it this way in a North American film because the actor, they'd be very worried about them getting injured.
Yeah. I mean, that's famous. Hong Kong, yeah, famously, they don't really care about their stuntmen. And it's like, yep, you're going to do this fall and you're going to land on some concrete because we can't hide a mattress here. So you're just going to have to take the pain of it. I mean, I think in terms of what you were just saying about rounding out the edges, I think also, like, by that period in the 90s, and you know, I think Chan was a bit older by then, so I think probably, you know, he was sort of slowing down a bit, and also probably he was, you know, God knows how many bones he'd broken by that point, probably didn't want to put himself quite on the line as much as he had done in, you know, some of the stuff he was, you know, that wild stuff he was doing in the 80s.
I totally get it. It makes complete sense. And even the blooper reel in this, which I forgot how much I miss blooper reels watching this today. And I'll start the campaign now if there isn't one going. We need more blooper reels at the end of films where we see the stunts go wrong, because it's like just watching, like, You've Been Framed. I just love seeing that sort of stuff. It just shows how real it was the whole time. It just highlights how real it is. Maybe that's why they don't do it now, because everything is just a facsimile on a green screen.
Well, there's the moment where, like, the snowmobile jumps over his back.
Yeah.
And it just barely misses him. I mean, like, can you imagine Brad Pitt doing that stunt? Not a chance in hell.
Well, they were worried about him throwing the chair off the roof in Spy Game. That's just throwing a chair.
Yeah. They were like, calling the stunt team to handle this one.
Yeah. You know, throw his back out. Okay. Okay, well, that's sort of our introduction to Jackie. I'm guessing they can... You saw that as part of those, you're watching Jackie Chan's films. That's when you saw this film in sort of the 90s, around about when it came out. Is that fair to say?
Yes, I saw it in theaters. Yeah.
Okay. And Will, is that about the same, or were you a latecomer to First Strike?
I was a latecomer to First Strike. So I think I first saw this film about 5 years ago because I'd heard it had an exploding helicopter in. So I needed to tick it off the list.
Due diligence.
Due diligence. So this was the first time. This was going back to this film in quite a while.
Okay, great. Okay, different like looks on this film that we've got here then. So I guess we need to pivot into how this film was made and why this franchise decided to spy itself up.
So this movie was actually an attempt to broaden Jackie Chan's appeal in North America, because he tried previously. You had the Cannonball Run films in the 1980s, that he appears in.
Does he? And then, with Roger Moore?
Yeah. Yeah, he doesn't share screen time with Roger Moore, but he is in the movie also. And he also made a movie in the 80s called The Protector with Danny Aiello. That was another action film that just did not do well in North America either. Mm-hmm. And so this was kind of like a later career push for him to get some grounding in North America, because he was already a huge international star. And so you had Police Story in 85, Police Story 2 in 88, and then Super Cop, Police Story 3 in 92. And so they designed this movie to be a Police Story 4. But part of me wonders if that was just to kind of like be able to sell it to its home market under kind of a known name, so it didn't feel like they were completely abandoning that audience by making this very kind of North Americanized movie. Because you had Maggie Cheung, who played his girlfriend in the previous three films, who's not in this movie. I think in many ways it feels very divorced from those first three.
And that, obviously, yeah, as you said, that was a choice to sort of broaden the sort of horizons and expose Jackie to a bigger audience. But it is a bit of a shame that they drop all those sort of connective tissue. But then again, people wouldn't know any of that stuff going into this film. That's why it's said as First Strike, not, you know, Police Story 4.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, we were just told it was Jackie Chan's First Strike.
Yeah.
And it was like, okay, cool. Fair enough. Yeah.
Is like the police inspector in the other films, like his uncle? Is that a through line?
That's the one crossover character. And actually, Bill Tung also appears in Rumble in the Bronx. So okay. he's a regular in Jackie Chan films. And the person directing and writing this movie, or co-writing it, was Stanley Tong, whose name pops up a lot if you watch Jackie Chan films. And he was a Hong Kong-born stuntman and actor. He went to the University of Manitoba in my native Canada, apparently, which was kind of a surprise. Huh. But he started out in the early 80s and was inspired to join the industry by his brother-in-law, who was the famous kung fu star Li Lo. And I wasn't familiar with this actor, but apparently was a huge star in his era. And so Stanley Tong started off doing second unit in the 1987 film Shanzong Lizu, and then had a huge breakthrough when he directed the 1991 film, it was self-funded, called The Stone Age Warriors. This movie was like a big deal, and he was not only the writer, the director, but also the producer of the film. Mm-hmm. And so that got the attention of Golden Harvest, which was a huge film studio. Actually, Golden Harvest, for 90s kids like myself in North America, they produced the Ninja Turtles film, the first one. And so that opening title card, I always remember from that movie.
Is that the company that's also connected to Enter the Dragon?
I believe so. I may be wrong about that, but I think so.
I recall that from when we did Enter the Dragon last year, or maybe there was some sort of connective tissue to them. I'm not sure, but yeah, go on.
Yeah, so Golden Harvest was really excited about the Stone Age Warriors and brought in Stanley Tong to be a director for them. Mm-hmm. And he directed, going off of that film, Police Story 3 Super Cop, massive hit. Then he teams up again with Michelle Yeoh to do Super Cop 2. Then he goes on and does Rumble in the Bronx and First Strike. So he goes on a streak of like kind of all-time action classics. And he actually made the jump to North America a little tiny bit before Jackie Chan. Actually, it would have been at the same time, maybe, if he's shooting Rush Hour in 97. But Stanley Tong came over and directed the Leslie Nielsen film, Mr. Magoo, which was a real disaster. And he did a couple episodes of the TV show Martial Law with Sammo Hung, which was a hit show for a while, but then went back to Hong Kong and has just shot films there. Still works with Jackie Chan, though. He did a movie with him fairly recently.
I want to ask about Mr. Magoo, because you triggered my interest. I've never heard of this film. Why is it so bad? What went wrong?
I have never seen it. Okay. I just know it was such an abject disaster when it was released. It was one of those, like, I don't think many critics gave it higher than 1 star. It was a real Razzie kind of nominee film. Mm. Box office disaster, made like $4. And
what year was it?
97.
Oh, so Spy Hard year, right?
Spy Hard was the year before.
Oof, he had a couple of bad years. Our Leslie.
Yes, Spy Hard made money, though.
Yeah, it shouldn't have.
Yeah, and like Mr. Magoo was also... Do you know who Mr. Magoo is?
No.
He doesn't carry across the pond, perhaps? I don't know. He was a animated character who was basically had very poor vision, and so had these huge kind of Coke bottle glasses, but was always mistaking things in front of him. So when the movie came out in 1997, people, you know, organizations representing people who are visually impaired were not exactly celebrating this movie in the streets.
Is that where it went wrong?
There was so many reasons.
Okay.
There was so many reasons.
Okay, that's a weird thing for people to get, I guess, upset about. But yeah, I guess.
Well, Mr. Magoo is a character from like the 1950s or something. Like, this was a very bizarre thing to update.
Because I've heard that name before. Yeah, I feel like it was like in a pop culture zeitgeist thing, but just it didn't come over here. I mean, Will, had you any connection to Mr. Magoo?
I remember, I've got a vague memory of seeing the cartoons when I was a very young kid. Sometime back in like the early 80s, and I remember them making a film of it, and I remember it being a disaster. And I've not seen it myself, but it's sort of one of those films that pops up and you just think, why are they making this film? Like, who is the audience for Mr. Magoo? Because he's not a big character over here in the UK. I don't know whether he's bigger internationally and there is some sort of, you know, thirst for seeing him again or something, but clearly if they did think that, they were wrong.
I'm just looking at some pictures of it online and I'm like, yeah, I'm glad I skipped it.
Apparently, and I remember reading a review, I think it was Roger Ebert's review perhaps, where he just said like, there's a lot of stunt doubles for Leslie Nielsen and they are all really, really, really obvious.
Okay. Fair enough. I can't say much more about Mr. Magoo.
Yeah. So Stanley Tong great career otherwise, but his dabbles in North American stuff didn't work out so well for mm-hmm. him. But reteamed with Jackie Chan in 2020 to do the movie Vanguard. So they're still working together, putting movies out.
Okay.
Yeah. And then this movie also had three other writing credits. Elliot Tong was one. Primarily, he's a producer who's known for movies like 2001's Scarecrow and Itchy the Killer. Itchy the Killer actually has a real cult fandom around it. But other than that, not a writer. So probably more of someone who was helping come up with scenarios for this film, sure. I guess.
Yeah.
And the other credits are interesting. Nick Tramontane, this is his sole writing credit. And he has nothing else on his filmography whatsoever. I have no idea who this man is, what he did. Was this just part of rewriting it for North America? Possibly.
So that was going to be my follow-up question, because this film has sequences that are shot in English.
Yeah.
And then scenes that aren't shot in English. And you can see the dubbing. And so like I assumed that this was made for Hong Kong and then just a couple of years later just exported with some extra scenes sliced in and a lot of stuff cut out of it. But it seems like there was an effort during production to have stuff for both.
Well, and the other writer was Greg Mellett, who started off in a 1994 B movie called Black Belt Angels,
mm-hmm.
did this movie, and then has just done direct-to-video action ever since. And I'm just wondering if whether it was him and the other writer we mentioned, if they were just writing the dubbing.
Sure. Yeah, could be. If you know a little bit more about it, let us know. But yeah, that's maybe they're just pseudonyms.
Could be, especially the one who that's his sole credit. Like, who is this man?
They're not quite proud of their work. They're like, hey, I'm Alan Smithy. I'm out.
Yeah. And so Bond was obviously a big influence on this movie. And, you know, Jackie Chan mentions Bond by name a couple times throughout the film. But the snowboarding sequence in the film was intentionally inspired by Honor Majesty's Secret Service.
Mm-hmm.
And Jackie Chan allegedly nearly died of hypothermia shooting it. So he went up to George Lazenby.
Well, they had the same amount of Bond films, technically.
That's true, yeah.
Jackie Chan is as much Bond as Lazenby is.
Yeah, I mean, Jackie Chan has other spy movies, so he is actually ahead of George Lazenby.
I suppose so. That's a good point. Yeah, he's got quite a few, actually, when you dig into it. I wasn't sure how they did that stuff on the ice. He looks cold the whole time. But then in the behind-the-scenes stuff at the end, you see him actually just like doing it for real in the snow. I thought like it was studio-based, a lot of it. Nope, they're just freezing their butt off. He's in that frozen lake, just frolicking.
Would it really killed them to let him have some gloves whilst he was... I mean, would it really have made a difference to the finished product?
I read Jackie Chan's autobiography many years ago, but it was about his training at the Chinese Opera School, mm-hmm. and just like the regimen that he went through, I mean, there's a reason this man is this tough and can endure this sort of stuff. It's like... most people don't have the level of training he has and the ability to withstand very, very, very unpleasant conditions.
What a specific set of training. But yeah, okay. Right? We're going to put you in the ice in Australia somewhere. Sorry, you're going to be there for hours.
Right?
It's crazy that he did it, but that's actually not the craziest thing he does in this film.
No, it is not. So this movie... was released in 1996 as Police Story 4,
mm-hmm.
but in North America, it came out in the start of 1997, and for the U.S. release, they edited out 24 minutes, which I think will definitely come up when we talk about the coherence of the film.
just a bit.
Yeah, they also cut the opening credits and replaced them, which is why you have that opening where it shows Hong Kong with the title card that says Hong Kong, and then just cuts to credits. It's very bizarre. That was not the original credits of the film.
Oh, that makes sense. I bumped on that. I was like, this is a weird edit.
Yeah, there was also like an opening song, and I don't know if it was James Bondy. Perhaps it was, but it was slashed out too. And they also changed the score. The original score was done by a composer named Nathan Wong, and they brought in J. Peter Robinson, who had done Wayne's World and Cocktail and The Bank Job.
Mm-hmm.
He would have done The Bank Job later, but those were his other credits that really jumped out. And he also created scores for the re-releases of Rumble in the Bronx and Mr. Nice Guy as well.
And this is just a spoiler. He did tremendous work with this film.
It's not bad, huh?
It's pretty good.
Yeah.
It sounds like The Living Daylights. So it's
got really that... does, yeah.
Yeah. See, I knew I wasn't going crazy. It does. Yes.
I would love to hear the original score, because I did notice when I was going through Letterboxd and reading reviews from fans, and a lot of them actually preferred this score to the original version, even though they preferred the original version for not being cut to shreds.
I mean, that makes sense. There's like even some like incidental music in this film that's good, that stands out. I don't usually notice scores, and I'll probably talk a little bit more about it later, but yeah, it's great work.
Yeah. And so in terms of like the release of this movie, we know it is Jackie Chan's first strike. It is only available in its original form in Chinese and Japanese physical media releases. I don't know if they perhaps, that's on the Wikipedia page I'm going off of, so maybe nowadays they have streaming versions of that, but over here, I apologize to anyone who's listening who treasures those original cuts. That's not what we have access to, unfortunately.
Yeah, I scoured around different ways to rent this, and it was all the 1 hour and 24 minute version everywhere I looked. Yeah. So I had no choice.
Same here. Yeah. And the movie had a couple alternate titles in its release as well, because obviously we've got Police Story 4, we've got Jackie Chan's First Strike. It was also known as Story of the CIA and Piece of Cake.
Piece of Cake. The movie.
Story of the CIA. It really isn't the story of the CIA. What?
Yeah, it's Story of the FSB, I suppose, if you're going to be specific.
Yeah, no kidding. I think of like Robert De Niro's, you know, The Good Shepherd, which is the story of the CIA. Mm. The idea of putting those two movies side by side is pretty funny in terms of owning that title.
Piece of Cake is really what I want out of that. Actually, I just want a piece of cake.
Yeah, totally. And so the box office on this one is just really tough to track, because I don't know what the Police Story 4 box office was. I'm just going to go off of what I am told according to Box Office Mojo for Jackie Chan's First Strike. So domestically, it did $15.3 million and international $6.6 million. I'm not sure of the budget, but I don't think the budget is particularly high for most Jackie Chan films. It depends on where you look. It ranks basically in the 80s or at number 100 for the year. So it was not as popular as, say, Rumble in the Bronx in terms of drawing in audiences to the theaters. Mm-hmm. And so the top three for that year, and I'm just going to go off of 97, which is the North American, we had Titanic, The Lost World, Jurassic Park, and Men in Black. And number four was Tomorrow Never Dies, with Jackie Chan's former co-star, Michelle Yeoh, obviously. Mm-hmm. And then for 96, the year it was released in Hong Kong, the top three were Independence Day, Twister, and Mission Impossible worldwide.
Man, the 90s was so cool.
Right?
I want to go back. Please take me back. I had hair and better taste in music back then.
I know. Now you'd go down those top threes and it's like Jurassic World Dominion.
Argyle. Oh, wait. That's not making any top tens, is it? No.
No. This movie also had some award nominations. Mm-hmm. Police Story 4 was nominated for Best Action Choreography at the Hong Kong Film Awards, and it won that. And it was also nominated for Best Picture, Actor, New Performer for Annie Wu, and Editing. So it was quite celebrated over there. And Jackie Chan's First Strike, the North American version, was nominated for the 1997 MTV Movie Award for Best Fight.
The MTV Movie Awards, the bastion of the highest caliber you can get when it comes to awards, never mind the Academy. Did it win?
It did not win. It was nominated. So I was like, wait, who beats Jackie Chan? So here's the other nominees, and I'll close it out with the winner, okay?
Okay.
Also nominated, Matthew Broderick versus Jim Carrey in The Cable Guy. So that'd be the fight on the satellite dish at the end.
Are you mad? What? What?
Jim Brown and the Martian in Mars Attacks, where it's the boxing match.
That's like 20 seconds long.
Pamela Anderson versus Bad Guy in Barbed Wire.
Oh, come on.
And the winner who beat them all,
uh-huh,
Fairuza Balk versus Robin Tunney in The Craft.
What?
It was like a witchcraft movie. It was very popular in the time. I've never seen it.
I mean,
it's a good film.
Is it? Yeah, I've never checked it out. They did a sequel, didn't they?
I think they did. I think they might have also done a remake. It's not a series I'm terribly invested in, but that first film is genuinely good.
Okay. I should check it out, because it's fun to catch up with 1990s movies that I somehow passed over.
I mean, to be fair, this stuff hasn't changed. We live in a world right now where Rachel Zegler and The Hunger Games, the song, the Ballad of Songbirds and Snakes, beat Mission Impossible Dead Reckoning and John Wick 4 for best stunts.
That's right, yes. That we kind of predicted that one, though, didn't we?
We did. I'm very sad that we were correct about that.
Yeah.
All right, well, we're here, folks. It's time to talk about First Strike. Let's put on a pair of koala pants and get down to action. Will, you're our guest. You are our aficionado for all things exploding helicopters. Why don't you lead us off with your thoughts on First Strike?
Not my first viewing of this film. And I think my opinions on it this time round were similar to my impressions on my first viewing sort of 5 or so years ago. It's an entertaining film, but I think ultimately it's quite a disposable film. I watched this at the weekend and it's already fading in my mind. I mean, there's lots of action in this film. It's certainly stuffed full of action, but I'd say there's probably only one standout moment, or, you know, maybe two. Certainly nothing to compare. Like, the first Police Story film's got a fantastic sort of spectacular stunt at the beginning of that film where they just drive a couple of cars through an entire sort of shanty town and just destroy the whole thing. And I mean, there's multiple stunts that I can remember from that film. Whereas I think this, as I say, this one's already fading in my mind. I mean, on the plus side, it's very brisk. It really rattles along. There's not much dead time in it. And it is quite, there's quite a lot of energy going on with this film, but it's as you sort of mentioned at the top, this film does suffer from the fact that it seems to have been chopped to pieces somewhere along the line. It's very, very, very jumpy. I think the villains are quite unsatisfying in this film, and that may that may be a product of the edits that have gone on here. So, you know, I think you can still enjoy this film. There's a sort of cartoonish quality to it. You know, it rattles along. It doesn't take itself seriously. There is some good action in here. So yeah, I mean, I think you can watch it and enjoy it. But I don't think anyone really be adding it to their sort of like favorite ever films.
Wait, I thought those villain performances were very subtle and nuanced. I don't know what you're talking about.
I'm not going to come out swinging for the FSB team, but I was a big fan of the very, very bulky men in very, very bulky suits chasing Jackie Chan around. Those men, their heads did not match the rest of their body. It was unsettling watching these guys chase Jackie Chan around. One that turns out went on to be a wrestler in the WWE. But the rest of them, like, basically nameless, of no credits to their name apart from this film. I assume they just raided a gym.
Yeah, that's an excellent question. I don't know.
Yeah, the two guys that fight him in the hotel room give me pause, because the guy with the glasses, the guy that talks more is the one who became a wrestler, Nathan Jones, I think is his name. But the other one, like, he wears glasses. His head is tiny compared to the rest of his body, and it is so, like, something it just feels off. It's like you're watching AI, except it's not. It's like an approximation of what a human should look like. Maybe an alien designed this, I don't know. But yeah, they look like they've been sort of inflated in their suits, like someone's pumped air into it and they've just sort of expanded outwards. So yeah, when it comes to villains, I'll stick up for the inflatable men.
I'm just surprised we haven't seen them like a billion times, because like they fit a specific mold that's tough to find, right? Like, it's kind of like when you go back to the older days and Richard Kiel's showing up as heavies all the time, because where else are you going to get these towering, you know, imposing dudes who can act? And I'm just surprised, like, that guy with the glasses you mentioned.
Whoa. Who can act?
Well, like, I mean, physical fighter types who can do action sequences who can also act. Like, that's a tough quality to find, because a lot of actors are actually on the shorter side. And so I'm surprised they... like, that guy with the glasses wasn't in high demand, and it's not someone I recognize from like a billion action movies.
He's not even like got name credit on the Amazon IQ thing you watch when you're watching on your telly, and it tells people who are on the screen. It doesn't even recognize who he is. He's that unknown.
Maybe he was like a set dresser and they were like, we need someone for the action sequence. Get in there.
we need someone to fit this oversized suit. Where can we find an oversized man?
There's one.
I mean, it does look like, as you say, like they raided a gym or they were in a nightclub and they just saw, hey, these two guys working the door here, they could really do a job in our movie. Let's bring them in.
Those guys are the door. Size of them.
And they're brilliant because Jackie Chan is not a tall man at all. And no. So when you put him opposite them, it makes for a great effect. Like, it's better than most visual effects you see in movies.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah, so I'll stick up for those villains. But I do agree with some of your other points there, Will. But I'll throw it to you, Cam. What do you think of First Strike?
So this was an interesting one for me because I had watched, you know, First Strike in the theater, and then I also watched it a few times at home. And for me, one of the things that was always very appealing was, I feel so stupid. When I was young, I was like, I can't believe Jackie Chan did all those action sequences surrounded by live sharks. And as I sat there watching it last night, I was like, oh my God, I was dumb as a post. Like, holy smokes.
Well, there's your Thunderbolt connection as well, I suppose.
I'll have more to say about the shark stuff later on.
Oh, okay.
But,
yeah, fine.
Quite a bit to say about it, actually. But this one to me was a little bit, it kind of lowered my nostalgia for this one a little bit. Mm-hmm. Rumble in the Bronx is, like, I think my favorite of his North American releases, the ones that were, you know, more theatrically shown. Drunken Master 2 or Legend of Drunken Master, depending on the titling, is probably the best one. This one has, I think, a couple standout sequences that really impressed me and little moments of Jackie Chan. But I think the problem for me with this one, watching it now, and not something I would have cared about when I was 16 or 17 years old, is that a lot of this movie is very plot-based. And because the plot is cut to shreds, it is just really, really frustrating. Smoke was coming off my pen as I was trying to keep track of the plotting of this movie. I still can't explain it to you. They take away that CIA agent at the end, and I'm like, I thought he was like a good guy who'd been forced into this position. I don't understand what just happened. So in terms of the storytelling, this movie is an absolute jumble and one of the most confusing movies to explain ever. It's standing next to Tenet at the moment. But in terms of the action sequences, I had a lot of fun and I enjoyed it. So in terms of the Jackie Chan excellence, it's there. But I think his better movies have much simpler plots where you're like, oh, okay, Rumble in the Bronx. You know, my uncle's store is in danger from street thugs. Great. Got it. Let's roll. This movie depends a lot on, you know, heel turns and machinations from various organizations, and I just found it really frustrating in that regard.
I was going to bring up the old Tenetometer. It doesn't come up very often that we bring it up, but yeah, this is definitely falling more towards the Tenet side of it than something that's a far lighter affair, but it shouldn't.
Yeah.
It has no right to be this complex for an 80-minute film. This film, maybe I'll segue this into my thoughts as well, is at its best when it's just giving you Jackie Chan.
Mm-hmm.
If Jackie Chan's just going nuts and kicking people's butts, yes. And there's about
the simple objectives.
Yeah, like he has to get to this thing. He has to save this woman in the water. He has to defend this person underneath umbrellas. They make sense. But all of the stuff with, you know, is it the FSB? No, it's Russian gangsters. Are they working for them, against them? Is this the CIA? Isn't it? I've watched this twice today. Once yesterday, once today. And I still can't tell you the plot. and that actually, it tracks.
Yeah, I mean, there's some plutonium.
Yeah.
There's a nuclear weapon that somebody wants. Quite why, how, who ultimately wants it. I mean, yeah, it's bamboozling.
That tracks with what you said, though, Will, that like a lot of it's disappearing from your memory already, because there really isn't any solid plot to the film. It's just and Cam likes to use this terminology when he talks about comedies, but like a clothesline for action sequences in this case. This is just an excuse to have Jackie Chan do fun stuff. Great, I'm signed up.
And that hurts the film. I mean, some people can watch films and, I don't know, they're not too bothered by the plot, but I need to kind of care,
yeah,
about the objectives of the hero. I need to care whether the villain, you know, fails or succeeds. Like, what, you know, what, I mean, what are the stakes in this movie? I mean, I don't know. Somebody wants a nuclear weapon, but we're not told that they're ever going to let it off. Some Middle East countries are trying to get it, but what are they going to do with it? I mean, there's no stakes here. So ultimately, just it feels sort of watching it, it's a bit like an academic exercise, just watching Jackie Chan do some stunts. And because there's no purpose behind it, just, yeah, really hurts your ability to actually give a damn about what you're watching on screen.
And I suppose then that pivots me into what I was going to say, because, you know, The first time round I watched this, I was really quite charmed by it. I found the lack of plot quite frustrating, but just seeing Jackie Chan in, maybe slowing down a little bit mid-90s, but still going full Jackie Chan in my books. Like, he's doing some amazing stuff on screen. The stuff on the snow, the stuff with the ladder, that stuff was crazy.
Yeah.
Great sequence. But the second viewing I found far more frustrating when I was trying to focus on what was actually going on and why things mattered. And none of the characters have any sort of arc, except maybe Jackie Chan.
Or dimension. It's not even arcs.
Or dimension, yeah.
Yeah, they have nothing.
Sure. And so I just thought to myself, I'd rather watch a 20-minute highlight reel on YouTube of Jackie Chan's best stunts than watch this.
Hmm.
Because at least you get the best stuff, and it has no connective tissue to anything else. But this film doesn't have any connective tissue. It is just literally stunt sequence, great, like A1 pucker, 5-star stunt sequence, and then badly overdubbed dialogue that's cut to ribbons anyway, so you can't understand it. Then you put a koala joke in, and then you do another stunt sequence. Like, that's all you've got. And that's not to say this is necessarily bad. If you're watching for the first time, you'll probably have a little bit of fun just watching the stunts, at least. But even then, you've seen them a few times, you've seen them. And after all that, though, I still find it slightly charming.
No, yeah, me too. I had a lot of fun watching it. This is not an unpleasant movie to watch.
No.
It's just like, if you are to critique it under the standards you would most movies, it doesn't measure up.
No.
Like, just because of the editing. And I feel bad because, for all I know, the hour 47 version makes complete coherent sense.
Sure.
And is a much better film. But unfortunately, we don't have access to it, so we can't really critique that. We have to critique what's in front of us. And in its edited down form, it's really confusing. And on one hand, maybe that works in some ways because Jackie Chan is confused throughout the entire movie.
Mm-hmm.
Like, his character doesn't know what's going on. So I very much could relate to him throughout this film because I didn't know either. But the movie's also stopping dead a lot of times to focus on side characters talking about things you don't really understand. And that's where it kind of gets disruptive, even though a lot of the movie is Jackie Chan stunts, and that's where the fun is. But can anyone tell me what happened to Natasha? I'm still confused. Where did Natasha go? No one?
There was a flashback about halfway through about their connection, and that was the last you ever saw of her.
Because we know that CIA agent, the character Jackson, who's played by Jackson Liu, he's someone who I was very confused by early on because he's showing up in different wigs and things like that. And then he's revealed to be a CIA agent. And we're like, oh, he's sympathetic. He got forced into this by the Russian mob. I understand where this character is coming from, sort of. And Natasha was in danger, so he had to do these things. But the movie ends with him being hauled off. And it's like triumphant music. And I'm like, I thought he was a sympathetic character. And where did Natasha go?
You're asking the right questions. And you know, I was saving this till later, but you mentioned Jackson Liu's wigs.
Yeah.
And I just have to say, Jackson Liu's wig collection puts Bruce Willis's wigs in the Jackal to shame.
They're bizarre, huh?
It's crazy. Like, there's no... The first... Like, when I saw him take it off the first time around, and Jackie acts all surprised, I'm like, come on, brother. You're meant to be a cop. You can't even tell that's a wig. What are you doing?
It's like a Farrah Fawcett wig.
Yeah. But we are spinning off into critiques. Let's talk about the good stuff. Let's celebrate First Strike. So, Will, I'll throw it to you. Something you really loved about the film you'd like to talk about.
Well, I think the first 20 minutes or so of the film, I think they work really well. And, you know, all the stuff that is taking place in Ukraine, all the stuff in the snow, there's some wild stunts there with the it's not jet ski, is it? What was it?
Oh, the snowmobile.
The snowmobile. I love the winter soldiers that just suddenly pop up and emerge out of the snow, like Jason and the Argonauts. I mean,
so cool.
Don't ask why. Don't ask how. Just enjoy the kind of the audacity of that particular moment. So I really enjoyed all of the snow stuff, all the stuff in the snow there. Kind of, I think we've already mentioned that, yeah, it feels very Bondian in terms of like on a Majesty Secret Service or even the beginning of A View to a Kill. And actually, this film did remind me of quite a few Bond films because it feels like it starts like A View to a Kill. Then it turns into Octopussy. I'm thinking all the stuff with the stilts and the fancy dress there, and then ends a bit like Thunderball. So yeah, it feels like a sort of cut and paste of various Bonds.
I'll call it a love letter to Bond, but yes, cut and paste of Bonds. That also works.
Yeah, and I actually think, you know, when you compare that opening snow sequence that you mentioned there with the snowmobiles like diving over stuntmen and people just bailing off those things, I think they actually did it better than The World Is Not Enough did with their snow sequence. I think this one was way more thrilling, and there was like a real sense of danger to it. When I'm watching those guys on snowmobiles like dive off a cliff, I'm like, holy smokes, like this is intense stuff. And to see Jackie Chan snowboard off that cliff and grab onto the helicopter, I mean, no offense, Pierce Brosnan, but Jackie Chan went up to you big time there.
He did. And I'll challenge anyone watching this film that has seen On Her Majesty's Secret Service to not whisper to themselves when one of those stunt guys hits a tree off of the snowmobile and goes, he's branching out.
Oh, wow.
That's well, okay. Maybe it was just me. I laughed at that, but it was nice. But yeah, I loved the whole snow opening. And of course, it leads to the two exploding helicopters.
Yeah.
It certainly does indeed. We get to see two Bell 206 jet rangers be blown up, and I obviously always enjoy helicopters being blown up, but I thought it was executed very well in this film. I love how the sort of wreckage for both of them, just sort of we get to see it falling to the ground, and a few lingering shots and endangering Jackie in those moments as well, so just adding to the peril and jeopardy he's facing in this film.
It makes me question, because, you know, you said you've been finding more and more films that have exploding helicopters. There's all these Bond films that have exploding helicopters. Is it cheap to blow up a helicopter?
It depends on, I guess it depends on your budget. So, I mean, you see various cheats. If you're operating at the low end of the budget spectrum, then you might just buy some footage from another film that has blown up a helicopter and splice it into your own one. You might switch from a real helicopter to a miniature of a helicopter to blow it up.
Sure.
So that's again a cheaper option, depending on, or can be expensive depending on how dedicated you are to realizing that scene with a miniature. And then I guess if you're at the sort of Christopher Nolan end of filmmaking, there is no substitute to actually blowing up a proper helicopter, as I think he blew up an actual jumbo in Tenet, I think it was. So
yeah,
I mean, it can be very cheap or it can be very expensive, depending, you know, your budget dictates.
You mentioned model work, and now I'm just thinking, did you see the helicopter explode in GoldenEye?
I think there's two that explode in GoldenEye. So if to, which one are you referring to?
I'm thinking of the fancy one that they steal, and they knock out Bond and Natalia and leave them tied up inside.
Yeah,
you do see it. Yeah.
Yeah.
After they eject.
Yeah. They use a model, I think, on that one, so that makes sense. Well, okay, we all agree on loving the snow opener, the cold open. Hey-o! I'm here all week, folks. Cam, something you liked.
I mean, this movie is just, like, a tribute to the physicality of Jackie Chan. So, like, when I was saying there's a couple standout sequences, I'm thinking of the snow opening that we just talked about. I'm also thinking about that big ladder fight, scaffolding fight in the hall with the whole group of guys. And just the speed is unbelievable. When they all had the bows, like the bow staffs, I think that was where it hit, like just the crescendo of just unbelievability as you're watching Jackie Chan dodge all those hits and throw himself through the ladder opening, which, you know, you look at the bloopers at the end and see him like catch himself doing that. And you're like, oh, that looks painful, painful to try to do. Mm-hmm. But boy, is it incredible to watch. And I think this movie falls a little below a lot of the, you know, the top tier Jackie Chan, because it doesn't have as many unbelievable sequences. Mm-hmm. But a sequence like this really makes up for it. And it's just incredible to watch.
I haven't seen a Jackie Chan film in quite a while, just personally haven't watched one. So just to go back to this after watching a lot of them in my childhood, just had a very nostalgic feel to me of seeing that particular style, that unique style that he brings to action sequences, because there's something just so, maybe we're just ruined by modern cinema and everything being just not physical. there obviously are films like Dead Reckoning and John Wick, but
yeah,
you know, just seeing him get whacked in the face in the bloopers at the end from that cane to the face, like you're like, yeah, that was timed to a millisecond, and it missed and knocked him for six, but that could all go wrong in a split second, and it just makes you appreciate the craft.
Well, I mean, you also just look at just his physicality in even like smaller sequences where he's like breaking into like into like an apartment or whatever, or a hotel room, mm-hmm. and it's just him like scaling a wall very quickly, but like so like
smooth,
like athletically, yeah, smoothly and athletically, that you're like, mm-hmm. this is the kind of thing that's a throwaway moment in his movie. It's just like, oh, Jackie, break into this hotel room, but the way it's shown on screen,
yeah, where he runs into the swimming, the kind of the aquatic center, he kind of just sort of runs up like some brickwork that yeah. is there, and that yeah, that's just a, as you say, just a sort of throwaway moment, but it's just like, who else does that?
And I think of like the moment where he's being chased by the two thugs in the hotel room, and he has to get across the pool, so he just he jumps on an inflatable device and then skids along the water and gets off the other side. It's literally yeah. 2 seconds, but that is. And he probably didn't break to shoot that one bit. That was part of a longer sequence, and he had to get that right several times in a row. Just credit to the man.
It's just like there's like movie magic when you see him do those little moments. And we all show up for the big set pieces, but it's those little moments that kind of connect everything and make the movies fun to watch, even if the plot is baffling. It's just like finding those injections of Jackie Chan energy throughout. So to me, like, that's the joy. And even like a lot of the underwater stuff, has some issues with a mechanical shark on an arm, but but like just him being underwater, staging those fights is incredible stuff. Mm-hmm. And also running in front of that big like gushing geyser of water, there's like a few of them. Like, I don't think that would have felt great to do that stunt.
No.
And it's pretty incredible to watch.
I thought a lot about the spy comedy Top Secret during the underwater fight, just how long that is in that film, and the protracted sequence they do down here is about 10 years later this film, I'd say. I think there's maybe a little bit of a nod in there somewhere.
Possibly, yeah. And we've seen underwater fighting in Thunderball, one of the greatest films of all time. And you can see how 30 years later, they've actually taken an underwater fight and made it feel propulsive,
yeah.
which is really difficult to do. On a technical level, that's tough. And I think this movie really, is this the best underwater fight maybe ever? It's up there.
I'll put it out to you folks. You let us know. Is this the best underwater fight of all time in cinema? Ooh, Cam said to this. Well, I'll let you decide. I just love, I mean, speaking of the underwater fight just for a second, I just love that they are aware of oxygen.
Mm-hmm.
Like it happens with a lot of things in cinema, like bullets. People forget how many bullets are in a gun. And also you can only be underwater for so long because you can only hold so much breath. So they have to keep on giving him oxygen and he has to keep grabbing it off of the bad guys. And it's just a nice touch. It's just a nice touch.
Yeah. Oh, totally. Like they build in little complications. And that's something Jackie Chan movies are really good at, where it's not just he needs to focus on a fight. Maybe he wants to escape the fight. Like, he's always trying to do something else at the same time. He's trying to get oxygen. He's trying to save the female lead. Whatever it is, he's always being pulled in two directions in a fight, and I think that's really effective.
I think I did sort of highlight this score at the start and said I really love that, and so I won't really stick to that as my, like, I want to bring up, but I will say, folks, if you're not going to check out the film, just check out some of the tunes on YouTube. The score is up there. And there is the main sort of score, just it does sound like the Living Daylights. It is a real Bond homage in there. There's even like a couple of the Bond notes if you listen. It's not too heavy-handed, but it's enjoyable nonetheless. But I just want to highlight just how good this film looks.
Mm-hmm.
I was surprised. Obviously, they shoot a lot of it in Australia. I think most of it's shot in Australia. But I think a little bit is shot in either Russia or some sort of facsimile of Russia around it, because it looks like he's in St. Petersburg at one point.
Mm-hmm.
And I mean, just seeing the cinematography, it looks very, the color is very rich. It just looks like it's shot well, like it was a good cinematographer behind the lens who knew what he wanted to do and also capture all of those stunt sequences so well that we can sit there and follow the action, because you could choreograph the best scene in the world, but if the camera can't follow it, it's pointless. So I think the cinematographer did a great job with this film.
Yeah, I mean, it's just a very well-assembled Jackie Chan film, because I mean, Stanley Tong is just a pro at these things. And then, yeah, the cinematography is solid. You know, you're obviously, you beat the IMF to Australia by a couple of years, because obviously Tom Cruise will be there for Mission Impossible 2. But it gets across the kind of the Bondian glamour of visiting different locations with much less money, because Eon can just throw money at the at those Bond movies to make them look as beautiful as possible. But, you know, they're working with more limited, you know, finances for a Jackie Chan movie. But I think it does a good job kind of capturing that Bond kind of allure.
Isn't it crazy that this film looks better than Mission Impossible 2 when it comes to the Australia sequences?
Does it?
I think it does. I mean, it doesn't like have the big vistas of like Sydney Harbour and stuff. Like, you're missing that, of course. But I yeah. just feel like they do nothing with Australia when they're in Mission Impossible 2. They don't really highlight it too much where they are.
They have a koala in Mission Impossible 2.
Good call.
There you go.
Good call.
I don't think they do. Missed an open goal there.
Yeah. Argument closed. We've solved it. There is no koala in Mission Impossible 2. That's why it didn't make the knock list.
Well, I was like wondering, is this something they did at some point, is have koalas in people's hotel rooms? Because I don't know if that's safe.
Australian listeners, let us know. Have you ever encountered a koala in your hotel room? I'd be curious to hear.
I remember we had cockatoos that like showed up in our room when we accidentally left the sliding door open once. But sometimes lizards. Don't remember koalas, though. I think that would have stuck at the forefront of my mind.
Well, the koalas felt like an installation, though. Like, it was part of the room. Because yeah. they said like they hooked them up with like a good suite. So I feel like maybe if you booked a cheap room in this hotel, you'd get one koala. But if you have the president suite, you get two.
Oh, okay. I have held a koala. You could do photo ops there, but yeah, no koalas in my room.
You don't deserve koalas.
I don't.
I thought they were setting up a sort of a joke here with having the real koala in his bedroom and then also having the koala pants that he would at some point try to put on the real koala or something like that. I thought that they were setting something up there, but they didn't follow through that. Or maybe that's in the longer edit. Who knows?
I'm not sure I want to see Jackie Chan put a koala on.
I will say, you know, Will, you were talking about Jackie Chan comedy that doesn't work. I thought the sequence where he had to like strip down was actually one of the ones that actually did kind of work because it was funny in concept.
I didn't particularly enjoy that, but you know, we, you know, the world is big enough for us to have, you know, different comedic tastes.
We interrupt this program to bring you a special report.
Red Alert Spyhards, we are shaking things up over on the Patreon page.
That's right, we are launching an exclusive new show where we tackle the exploits of the small screen's greatest secret agents, like Jack Bauer, George Smiley, and beyond.
And don't forget, every month you also get two Agents in the Field episodes where we decode the adventures of your favorite spy actors in their biggest non-spy movies. But Cam, tell the people what we have coming up next.
Now is the time to catch up with our magnificent March offerings. I'm talking about reviews of Face Off and The Adventures of Tintin, as well as our latest OSS episode on The Night Manager. Check it out, folks. So much to enjoy.
So strap on your Condor Man wings and soar into the future with us over at patreon.com/spyhards.
But before Big O zaps us with a red pulsating laser, let's get back to the spy jinx.
Well, let's pivot over to dislikes then. I think, Will, you should lead us off again because you seem like the one who's perhaps the least happy with the film overall. What's something you wanted to highlight in terms of dislikes?
Well, running with this theme of the humor here in this film, it is something I don't get on terribly well with Jackie Chan in other films, and it crops up again here. So there's all various stuff in here. There's some sort of painful gags where he's finds himself in somebody else's hotel room and he's trying to pass himself off as a dry cleaner and then as the window cleaner. We then have the sort of the women ogling a naked Jackie Chan, and there's another sort of scene where he's fighting one of these big gym henchmen figures that have been brought into this film, and you know, there's a scene where he's fighting one of them, and for reasons that make sense in the film, he's covered in various sea creatures, and this guy's gurning very very theatrically as if he's in a cartoon sort of stuff, and I'm afraid that type of stuff is there to amuse, and I'm afraid it just doesn't tickle my funny bone. So, as I say, you know, I'm not here to dissuade anyone from finding those scenes amusing, but I'm afraid for me, they just really didn't land. And yeah, I couldn't wait for them to be over those scenes.
Well, I want to hear from Cam on this, because he's the one without any comedic bone in his body. So
That's true. I find the comedy in this one, in a lot of Jackie Chan movies, touch and go. Like, sometimes there's a sequence, like I said, like the moment where he has to strip down and put on like the mascot costume, and he's trying to like dial a cell phone in a mascot costume. I'm like, that's pretty funny.
Trying. He does it flawlessly first time. I was surprised by how good he was in that mascot costume.
Yeah. Like, that sort of stuff works. But the problem is that some of the comedy, a lot of like the verbal comedy, is just overdubbed stuff that just feels executed very awkwardly. And so it's not funny. It's just like, ooh, like that's really tough. Like the ending of the movie where it's like, I want you to write a detailed report, huh? And it's like staged really quickly, it's read really quickly, and you could tell they were just fitting it in over something, you know, over the dialogue and the amount of space they had. And it's like, stuff like that is just dire. As for the toxic sea creatures clearly labeled on the bin, that actor definitely milked that for everything it was worth at the end. I mean, I like the gag where Jackie Chan has like one or something on him, and, you know, kind of knocks it off. And then the bad guy has, like, I don't know, a dozen across his back. It's actually somewhat reminiscent of Raiders of the Lost Ark, where Indiana Jones has, like, the tarantula on him. Mm. And then Alfred Molina has, like, them all over him. So that was kind of, I think, a fun little gag. But, yeah, a little too much sauce on that one by the end.
He had to take his moment in the limelight, because he's immediately going back to Gold's Gym afterwards.
Oh, okay. That's true. Yeah.
Yeah. That was his 5 seconds of fame. I think I will pivot off with my dislike, because you kind of set it up there, Cam.
Yeah.
Actually, you both did. Was the dubbing. Mm-hmm. I'm not against dubbing in films. I prefer watching films with subtitles, personally. But the fact that this film jumps between bits in English to bits that are dubbed poorly. Also, and this is maybe bringing the editing a little bit here as well. The dubbing is done so quickly a lot of the times, you're getting massive important bits of exposition in the space of 3 seconds, because it's only got that amount of time of watching this guy's face. It's the only close-up they've got of him. A little bit like an inside baseball, that's how they do it. And so, yeah, the fact that they had to go this dubbing route, I think kind of actually is one of the core reasons why the plot doesn't make a lot of sense, because they didn't have the time to expand. And I think it really holds the film back. And it also just makes things feel much creakier. And I think there is a good film in here somewhere if they didn't do stuff like the dubbing. If it had a better plot and through line throughout, it doesn't. But I had a lot of trouble watching the dubbed scenes.
That's such a necessary evil when it comes to Jackie Chan movies, right? Yeah. Like, they're all like that. So it's like, if you're going to enjoy Jackie Chan movies, you just got to get used to it. And I remember it definitely took me some getting used to back in the day watching them. Yeah, it is like a technical knock against almost all those North American releases. And now that, you know, you've got Criterion putting out like the Police Story movies and some of his early work, hopefully we get better, perhaps subtitled versions of a lot of his work. But so far, that's not the case. And, you know, I grew up watching Rumble in the Bronx over and over and over again. I got used to the dubbing, but the dubbing takes away from the movie. Ultimately, it does.
Yeah, for sure. And what about you, Cam? Something you wanted to point out?
Like, it's so tough, because it's like so much of my gripe with the movie is just how hacked to utter shreds it is, which is such a, especially North American thing at the time, is to take foreign films and just cut them to pieces, which was something, you know, Harvey Weinstein did with Miramax a lot. It became like this common practice. And it's frustrating, because you're getting a reduced version of something that was probably better. Mm. So I'll say that. But like, I did think like Annie Wu's character in this movie, who turns just kind of into like the really kind of generic damsel in distress by the end. Mm-hmm. It's like, this is getting a little frustrating, because this is someone who has like underwater training, and like, let's play that up a little bit.
Yeah.
And when I compare that to, you know, the character, his girlfriend from the first three movies, she's a little more dynamic a personality and just, I think, a stronger actress. And here it's like, okay, this feels kind of like you're throwing in a Domino-like character because her brother is involved in this.
I was going to mention Domino. Yeah.
But like even Domino has a little more oomph to her because you have her taking down Largo at the end with the spear gun. You don't really, you know, give the Annie character a lot of moments like that.
I have to believe, I have to tell myself that in the full length version, the longer version of this film, she had more scenes.
I think so.
Because to be nominated for an award for like best supporting actor or something you mentioned at some awards, then I have to believe there was more there because what I was given here was a very, very stiff performance.
I don't even judge the performance too much because it's dubbed, so I don't know what the original performance is.
Sure.
But it just felt like in terms of the way they conceived that character, it just felt like there wasn't a lot there. And that's unfortunate. I remember as a kid, though, when I saw this movie, and again, I was like 16, that like I saw like the way I was interpreting it was like a romance between her and Jackie Chan. And as I'm watching it the other night, I'm like, how old are these people? And I look it up and she's like 18 years old. And I was like, oh, my God. Oh, no, no. Pull up. Pull up.
It's interesting that like of our dislikes, and I will actually say, Will, one of my dislikes was the humor. So we're in simpatico there. The other thing I didn't really bring up, and you mentioned about Annie Wu, but I think a lot of the other characters, even the ones who are speaking English in scenes, mm-hmm. are not putting in great performances. This is really Jackie Chan's show. I mean, it is in the title, Jackie Chan's First Strike, but
right,
you'd think there'd be a little bit more there.
Oh, the villains are all very stiff. Mm-hmm. It's pretty much across the board, yeah.
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 But that's a small thing. I suppose then I'll throw to final notes before we get to the knock list. Is there anything about the film, Will, you'd like to bring up you haven't mentioned already?
Well, there's I guess, two things I'd like to bring up. So the first thing is just after the snow sequences that take place in Ukraine or Russia, Jackie Chan is taken to Australia on a submarine, we're led to believe, in terms of the plot. And I did a few rough calculations, and that would take about 2 months for that submarine to get travel that distance. So that was interesting to think about. And then the other small detail that really stuck in my mind was at the beginning of the film, where Jackson is trying to flog the nuclear weapon. The person he's selling it to says that you know, he's going to pay for it with a check that needs 3 days to clear. And I'm just like, in what world of criminality in sort of international arms sales are people paying for things with checks that need to kind of clear through like through banking channels? I found that a sort of peculiar detail to, because it doesn't play into the film. So why even have it there? So bizarre.
I love it. The guy's like, oh, what? You don't trust me? No. You're an arms dealer. Of course I don't trust you.
Yeah, I mean, wire transfers did exist in those days. This is not a 1990s thing.
I think both valid points. I want to see the film set on the submarine between Russia and Australia. Just Jackie Chan just living on a submarine.
Jackie Chan's slow strike.
Oh, beautiful, Cam. Beautiful. Any Thank notes you. For us, sir?
Yes. The Oceanarium.
Ah.
I have severe questions about the operations of this facility.
I need to jump in and just preface to our guest, Will, and to listeners at home that have never experienced Cam's proclivities for the aquatic. He is a lover of all things nautical, especially sharks. So you have to imagine that when he saw this film the first time as a young man in the 1990s, he got very excited.
I did. But as I'm watching it last night, I'm more critical about its operations as a facility. We are introduced to the Annie character where she's in like a cage being attacked by great white sharks in the Oceanarium. Great white sharks cannot be held in captivity. That is not a thing that exists in the world. And to have multiple, I was like, wow, that's quite a feat. Okay, fair enough. I'm willing to go with it, just to suspend my imagination, although the sharks did look like the one from Jaws the Revenge, where you can see the mechanical arm just managing to prop it up outside of the frame. Very visible. But, okay, we know from a sequence at a certain point, Jackie Chan is leaning over into the water to see what's going on with the Annie character, and the great white shark pops up and scares the crap out of him, right?
Mm-hmm.
He falls in the water, he's flashing or splashing around, and a fin comes at him. And it turns out to be a seal. Why is this facility putting seals in the same tank as great white sharks?
It was lunchtime, Cam.
Clearly, because the seal is like the number one target for the great white shark. So this is a very cruel facility operating in Australia there.
Is this a new show? Mm. Maybe it's like an underground thing when it's turned off. They want to cull their seal population, so they just feed a couple to the sharks to keep them on side.
They also had a sign that said "Killer sharks do not enter," and I'm like, well, hold on. Like, first off, I would think people that work in a facility that caters to like fish and everything, they would not call them killer sharks. That seems rather derogatory. But also, I feel like the staff would be aware of the shark enclosures. Like, they don't need signs to say killer sharks.
You're really taking it to this film, aren't you? I mean, you've got problems. You should write to Jackie about this.
And lastly.
Okay. There's more.
There is the whole fight underwater. And I think what tricked me was that when I was a kid and saw this movie was there is a sand tiger shark swimming around that is real.
Mm-hmm.
And they look scary, but ultimately, if you're in the water with a sand tiger shark, you don't have to be as scared as if it was like a tiger shark or a great white or something like that. So when you have Jackie in, you know, filling the frame with a sand tiger shark, cool enough. But you can't have a sand tiger shark, which is a real living thing, next to these rickety great white shark models. It's very jarring.
I didn't expect we would come in this hot about the Oceanarium in wherever Australia they are, Brisbane or something like that. I can only apologize to our Australian listeners that Cam just doesn't understand how it's done down under.
I think I'm done.
Glad you got it off your chest.
Yeah, look out for the expanded episode later this week as Cam goes into detail about why the underwater sequences don't quite work for him.
That poor seal.
This is Cam's last strike.
Cam's fish strike.
I had a great pun and you just ruined it with like the world's worst pun.
Yeah, that's what I'm here for.
Okay, great. I suppose then the only thing I had left to add was, I was actually going to mention the fish stuff, but that's fine.
What were you going to mention about the fish?
I really liked it. I really enjoyed it.
It was fun.
It was more fun than Thunderball. Not the fight, but like the shark stuff. Like I felt like this, the shark stuff in Thunderball feels a bit icky because of how they treated those sharks.
Yeah,
this was probably a lot better.
Oh yeah, there is like a real joy to watching a stuntman get dragged into the mouth of a very fake looking great white.
Yeah, and all like the combat underwater was great. Like I mentioned Top Secret earlier, but like Jackie is able to move very fluidly in water. I know it is a fluid, I get it. But like, I don't think I can move that way underwater or above water.
Mm.
So it's just great to see. I suppose I was just going to ask then, what is everyone's favorite sort of sequence from the film? Will, I think you said it was a snow stuff. Is that what you would go with?
Yeah, the snow stuff or the ladder fight, which as Cam was talking about, I mean, that's just exceptional stunt work, just exceptional fight choreography. So I think those would be my two standout scenes.
I feel like I might go to B&Q and have a go at that myself. Now, that's a very British reference, folks. But if you read British Man is Arrested in B&Q for having a fight with the staff with a ladder, that was me. Cam, what was your favorite?
Yeah, it's the ladder scaffolding fight for me. As much as I love more of like the kind of James Bondy stuff, like mm-hmm. the snow sequence or the underwater, ultimately, like, the stuff that really wows me with Jackie Chan is more of that kind of street level fist fighting kind of stuff. That's the stuff where he really pulls his incredible stunts for me. So that's the one I go to.
Yeah, I think I'd say the same. I really enjoyed that. It did kind of feel like they were looking around an empty studio or something like that. And they just saw the scaffolding and thought, hey, we could probably choreograph something with this, and then just threw it in. But hey, it works.
Yeah, and it has like, I don't know, maybe 25 brilliant moments. Whereas when you watch so many North American action films, you're praying for that one moment. the one where you're like, holy crap. And this movie is just one after one after one.
And I will finally add, one thing Mission Impossible Fallout gets lauded for is Henry Cavill cocking his arms. I will point out that in this film, Jackie Chan does that. He did it first.
That's true. That's true. Yeah.
Sorry, Henry Cavill.
Where did he do that? I missed that moment. Where does that take place?
It's during the ladder fight. He just stands up at one point and sort of like just like pushes his arms down like that, and it's like, ah, okay. It's he's cocking his arms long before old Henry did.
Oh, I love
it. Sorry, Cavill fans. I'll be putting an image of that online. Don't worry, you can all see it. But there you go. That was First Strike. But will it make the knock list? Let's find out now. Cam, as we have a guest, please instruct our listeners who may be tuning in for the first time and will what the knock list is.
Yes, the knock list is our tortured acronym for Need to See Official Classics, where every week after we've talked about a movie, we debate whether it belongs on the list of the all-time great spy films. So some movies that made it on Goldfinger, North by Northwest, the Saoirse Ronan film Hannah, the James Mason film Five Fingers. We like to keep it kind of eclectic, so it's not just like pick the obvious choices. There's some oddities in there as well, like The Wrecking Crew, for example.
Yeah, absolutely. We have a broad variety of spy movies that have made the knock list, but is First Strike joining them? Let's find out. The first vote always goes to the guest. Will, is it making the knock list?
This is a fun film. This is a film that I enjoyed, but I don't think that it should be put on the knock list. I just don't think it has that need to see status. Not for me, anyway.
That's absolutely fine. I mean, I'd be interested to see what Cam says. He's not a big fan of the underwater sequences, so maybe he's already spoiled his vote. What?
I am. It's just, you know, let's be accurate with our shark representation here.
Okay, yeah, I'll let you start that campaign yourself. Okay, well, that's one no. It's all still to play for. Cam, what do you say?
It's a no for me. And one movie I should have cited also made the knock list was Enter the Dragon, which falls into that martial arts category and had Bruce Lee. And I think what that one did was, that was kind of like an encapsulation of what made Bruce Lee fantastic in a very fun spy film. And I think this one, it encapsulates what makes Jackie Chan really special. But the movie around him isn't as strong as some of his other work. So I walk away going, like, there's some great set pieces. Jackie Chan is fun to see. But is this even in maybe my top 10 Jackie Chan films? I don't know that it is. And so, yeah, it's a no for me, as much as I do find it fun. And, you know, I've seen it probably 5 or 6 times over my life. I could see myself watch it again in the future at some point as well.
Sure. Yeah, a lot to enjoy. Totally get it. But that's two no's, so it won't be making the knock list, and my vote is completely null, but I'll cast it anyway. It's a no from me, but it's one of those films that we talk about that I will always say was fun.
Yeah.
Like, it's not the greatest of all time. It's not need to see. But if you're looking for more martial arts films that have a spy influence in them, especially a Bond influence here, there's a lot to watch and enjoy. I'm glad it is 80 minutes, because I think if it tried to do what it was doing for another 20 more minutes, it would probably outstay its welcome, just of how confusing it is at times. But ultimately, I had fun watching it, and I will probably watch it again at some point. I'd love to see the original.
It'll be very interesting to see as we continue down the road, because we're going to tackle a number of Jackie Chan spy films, and a lot of them are not held in particularly high regard. And it's kind of a bummer that it doesn't seem like one of his kind of all-time movies crosses into the spy genre. This may be the heights. We'll find out.
Looks like Cam's already cast his vote on The Tuxedo. We will find out down the road.
The Spy Next Door, yeah.
Accidental Spy, yeah, there's a few of them. We should probably do one of his films on the Patreon at some point. He's got a lot of spy films.
Yeah, he does, yeah. We could totally do that.
We could probably do Police, the Supercop 1, the big one.
Yeah.
Michelle Yeoh as well.
Yep, yeah, that's Police Story 3, but yeah, Supercop, yeah.
Oh, sorry. Yeah. Yeah.
And it's got an exploding helicopter in, so you can enjoy that as well.
Sold.
Boom. Literally.
We may even be smart and try and bring that this week. We'll let you know. Who knows? But there you go. Three no's. The dossier on the film is complete and filed as classified. It's not making an Oculus. Sorry, fans of the film. Better luck next time, Jackie Chan. I want to say, Will, thank you so much for coming along, exploding a couple of helicopters with us, and hanging out.
Well, it's a pleasure to come and chat with you about a fun film.
Well, if people want to hear more from you, where can they hear the show? Where can they hear more from you online?
Well, if people are interested in finding out more about the strange ways that helicopters keep exploding in films, then they can check out my podcast, Exploding Helicopter, which is the cryptic title. You can find it anywhere you get your podcasts. We also have the Exploding Helicopter website, which is explodinghelicopter.com, where I've got a couple of hundred written reviews of films where helicopters explode. I'm on social media. Probably Twitter is the best place to come and find me, and you can find me there on as at Chopper Fireball.
Great handle, love the handle.
Wonderful
stuff. Well, you'll find links to that in the show notes below, folks, if you want to go check out Exploding Helicopter, and we recommend that you do. And you can find Will on social media, and but it's been an absolute pleasure having you on the show, sir. Well, there you go, folks. That was our chat about Jackie Chan's First Strike. I want to thank Will from the Exploding Helicopter podcast once again for coming on the show to bring his aerial expertise to bear.
Indeed, indeed. And this was a perfect matchup. So, you know, who knows? If Will comes back, you're going to have to do some research in advance to find other exploding helicopters.
Apparently there are plenty more spy films with exploding helicopters out there. We just didn't know about it. The more you know, folks, the more you know. And speaking of the more you know, Cam, what have we got coming up next week?
Scott, we're jumping from 96 to 69, 1969 that is, with Gregory Peck and the espionage thriller, The Chairman.
That's right, we're heading back to my favorite year, 1969, with Gregory Peck hanging out with Chairman Mao. And folks, this film is available for free on YouTube right now. There'll be links in the show notes below next week as well. So your mission, should you choose to accept it, is to join us right now as we check out The Chairman.
Mysterious.
If you like what you heard on this episode, please consider joining us over on our Patreon. Not only do you get access to a bunch of bonus episodes, which is, of course, lovely, but you're also helping to support SpyHards. We have to pay for a lot of things here, websites, hosting, the software we use to record these episodes, and everything you guys contribute just goes straight towards paying for that. We're not really looking to make profit out of this. It's really just to keep the lights on here at SpyHards HQ. So anything you guys can do is appreciated, and you'll find a link to that in the show notes below. Do not forget to follow us discreetly on social media at SpyHards. That's SpyHards on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. But until next week, Cam, I will follow you. Follow you wherever you go.